Today is Wednesday, April 28th, 2021. This is part 11 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Nancy Eileen Mulady Meekum, last name spelled Mulady hyphen Mecham. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Nancy. How are you today?
I'm good. It's a beautiful sunny day here in Arnold, California. Good to talk to you, Tom.
Great. Oh, it's wonderful to speak with you, Nancy. Nancy, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes.
Thank you so very much. Last interview, you had mentioned Judge Steve Verkamp, spelled V-E-R-K-A-M-P. Could you tell me more about the circuit court at Grand Canyon National Park?
I can. The circuit court, the U.S. Judge Magistrate's Court, worked as a circuit court in that he wasn't there all the time. He went to different courts. I couldn't tell you where else he went, perhaps on the reservation or all, but he showed up in the Grand Canyon, and at that time, people who had citations to appear in court were then required to appear in front of him in court. And so the location of this court was on right off of Center Drive on the loop across from Ranger Operations, adjacent to where the rec center and library and pub used to be. So after the rec center fire, then that was the only building in that area. And
I have a question about that building. Now, that was the original post office. Does it go back to the same time as Ranger Operations across the street? These really wonderful arts and crafts, sort of El Tovar kind of buildings.
Look like that. I can't say for sure if it did, but it certainly had the same architecture of it.
Okay.
But when you went inside, it had been gutted. There was an entryway which had secure doors, and so people could not go into the court until they went, got checked out, made sure they had no weapons. They checked in with a clerk, and then a bailiff, which is a court officer, would then allow them in when it was their time for court and provide security for the court. And the job of the bailiff, the court security, fell to South Rim Patrol Rangers.
Oh.
And so on occasion, I would have been and had been a bailiff. And it was just a matter of paperwork, making sure everybody was safe, secure, not intoxicated,
mm-hmm.
And weren't going to be a problem. Many folks who appeared in court often appeared with their own attorneys, especially if it was a DUI. And as a result of that, we had, at the time I was there, developed our own court officer. I believe it was Jennifer Cipher was there. She was Chuck Cipher's wife. He was a Canyon Ranger.
How do you spell their last name?
I believe Cipher.
Thank you.
I believe. And so when you went inside, there was none of the old art. There was a series of offices in the back, but there was a regular courthouse with benches and a dais above which the judge sat behind.
What does the court officer do?
The court officer is basically the prosecutor, presents the case,
okay,
and makes the case for the government. So it's usually the government versus Joe Blow or Jane Blow or whoever it is. And so in America, as you well know, people don't duke it out amongst themselves anymore. If they have a problem, rather than have people fighting all the time, the U.S. government as well as local governments had taken on the job of prosecuting people for wrongs, criminal wrongs, and not torts and not necessarily things that were not criminal, such as civil.
Mm-hmm.
So if somebody ran a stop sign and hit your car, rather than you going out and shooting it out or duking it out, officers of that court, belonging to that court, take the report, the court officer then reviews it and makes a presentation, often bringing the officers in to testify as to what they saw, what they did,
okay,
to present the case against that person.
Okay. This is a federal court.
Yes.
Is it true that the plaintiffs would have the ability to have the case transferred to their home magistrate?
No. This is a federal court in a specific jurisdiction.
Mm-hmm.
And jurisdiction, if the jurisdiction falls to wherever the crime occurred.
Okay.
And you are innocent until proven guilty, but a crime has occurred, and then they have to decide if you're responsible or not. So it's never in doubt that something happened.
Okay.
The doubt is whether you're responsible for it or not.
Okay.
And so when, let's say, somebody is pulled over for drunk driving, you know, they have to be in control of the vehicle, they have to be under the influence of alcohol, and in doing something wrong like driving a car or being a danger to themselves or a danger to property. So then they have to have field sobriety tests, have, you know, their breath analyzed. If they okay it, if they don't okay it, that's a violation right there.
Mm-hmm.
So and so those people, depending upon the situation, may be released after they are processed at the holding facility, may be then transferred to the Coconino County Jail in Flagstaff. When they sober up, if it's not a major crime, then they can post bail and be out on that bail, and then they are then given a notice to appear in court in front of the judge magistrate.
Mm-hmm.
And so they come back there. If they want to go somewhere, like if they're from Minnesota and they made this crime in the Grand Canyon, it happened in Grand Canyon, and that's where the court will happen. So if somebody flies home to Minnesota and their court date is in 6 weeks, they have to fly back to the Grand Canyon.
I see.
Oftentimes, though, and this is where the court officer comes in, she will make a plea agreement with someone. Let's say it's not a drunk driving, something not as heinous, but let's say it's shoplifting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they can say, you can come back and plea your case in front of the judge and maybe get a lesser sentence or maybe get off, or we can, you could just say, I did it and pay this fine, and then you don't have to fly back. And a lot of people do that because they know they did something wrong, mm-hmm. and they don't want to make the expense of coming back.
Right. Okay.
And this is especially true of people from another country.
Sure.
It's interesting how people from another country like to take things, especially license plates from off cars as souvenirs. Sometimes they often shoplift in the store.
Hmm. Okay.
And I would if I was called and I would talk to them and they were caught with the stuff right there, and I would say, you know, normally you have to appear in front of the court or you can just pay the fine. And we had a Code of Federal Regulations which had the fine outlined.
Okay.
And I would often help the people because there was a bank right there and everything. It goes, well, we don't want to come back from Germany or Czechoslovakia or wherever the heck they were from, and we want to pay the fine. We were wrong. We did this wrong. So oftentimes I would help them do it. You know, they'd go get a cashier's check, and they'd mail it in the envelope, put it in the post office, and I said, don't do it again.
Great.
So that took a lot of time to do that, but that was, I'd like to say I was the service in National Park Service.
Right.
So not just, you know, helping everybody that was good, but helping the people who didn't do well and often were remorseful and said, geez, how stupid can I be? And
mm-hmm,
thank
mm-hmm.
you for helping me kind of thing.
Yeah.
But for people who had mandatory appearances, and so if somebody is created, has done a wrong, then I can give them a warning. I can write them a ticket, and then they send the ticket in to whatever the address on the ticket is, and include a check or money order for the, it's still called a bail, but for the fine on the ticket. Let's say they were speeding, and that's not a reason for them to have to come all the way back to court. They just have to pay the ticket.
Right.
And, or it's a mandatory appearance. We think that the fine isn't going to be adequate, and the judge needs to hear this, and the judge needs to make the decision as to what the penalty should be.
Okay.
And so that's a mandatory appearance. And then the fourth level is to arrest somebody. And then they are brought into court, usually in Flagstaff, where they are released, remanded, et cetera, there. So sometimes we'd have to go all the way into Flagstaff, pick up people at the Coconino County Jail, and bring them all the way back to the Osage Judge Magistrates Court, for them to be tried or released or given a court date and taken all the way back to jail if it was an egregious crime.
Uh-huh.
So there was a lot of
road work. Yeah.
A lot of road work to it.
Was Judge Verkamp the first judge that you interacted with?
No, and I wish to goodness gracious I could remember the name. He was a young guy in his 30s. I remember he had dark hair. He laughed a lot, and he was very much a people person. And I remember he had to leave, I think because his sister got MS or something like that back in the Midwest. And we were sorry to see him go because he was so easy to work with. Not that Judge Verkamp wasn't, but he was a different personality. And Judge Verkamp was somebody whose family belonged in the Grand Canyon for generations.
Right.
They owned a store called Verkamp's there. And I believe he went to the high school at Grand Canyon.
Right.
So the issue that we had with Judge Verkamp is he was very much an autocrat. He decided that the Grand Canyon was his. And but he didn't like heavy-handedness. He didn't like cops, if I could use that term.
Mm-hmm.
Park rangers who acted more law enforcement oriented. He was very pro-resource management. And so if anybody poached a deer, cut down a tree, carved their name in, you know, the side of the canyon or spray-painted something, man, he lowered the boom on them. If somebody was, in his opinion, quote, harassed by the rangers, he would give the rangers a talking to, you know, in court.
Good.
Remonstrate them. Oh, gosh,
uh-huh.
Yes. So, and, you know, a lot of people, because he wasn't very tall, thought maybe he was compensating. But I think he was somebody who really cared about it. I do remember, I don't think I told this. You can stop me if I told this story before. But I was a naturalist when I first met Judge Verkamp. And I had already worked a season as law enforcement with the other judge. And that next winter, when I was a seasonal 6 months, I was a naturalist at Yavapai Museum, used to give geology talks, and I remember he showed up because he introduced himself later on as Steve Verkamp, and he was kind enough to say nice things about it to the point where he came back at least one other time with family or friends to hear the talk again. So it was a nice compliment to him.
Yeah, very much
so. The next season, when I went back, as you recall, I was working 6 months interpretation, 6 months as a protection ranger.
Mm-hmm.
When I went to the law enforcement refresher, he saw me in the audience and he says, "You don't belong here." And I said, "Well, yeah, this is my job." And he goes, "No, you're an excellent naturalist. You're wasting your time being a protection ranger.
Mm-hmm.
What are you doing here?" So he was the kind of personality who decided he knew what was best. And I said, "Well, you know, nothing I can do." And luckily for me, that's when I got called out on a wildland fire.
Well, I'll see you later, so, Your Honor.
But he was very upset to see me in law enforcement and not a full-time naturalist. But you know what? I wasn't offered a full-time naturalist job, even though I applied.
Right.
So,
right.
And
you know, you have the skills to be great at whatever you do. So you should have known that. So.
Well, he just knew me as a naturalist. He just knew I'd give walk talks. So.
Right.
So that season, you know, I would be a bailiff, I'd take people to court, and we would make our case to Jennifer, and then sometimes we would come into court and we would sit in the benches until it was our term. If we weren't the bailiff at the time, we were part of a case being presented.
Okay.
And so we would then be called up to testify as to what we said, what we did, and usually, especially if it's a DUI, and the client is fighting it, they would bring in somebody with an attorney who would then, you know, cross-examine you and try to say your character was bad or what do you know about this and all that stuff. So you'd have to bring in, and we often brought in our binders showing our training in law enforcement, training in DUI, what we did this. And this especially came up not in DUIs, but speeding tickets. And one of the things, one of my colleagues, Kent Keller, K-E-L-L-E-R, he was in charge of the radar guns.
Okay.
And they have to be synchronized, and they had to be calibrated on a regular basis.
Right.
So somebody who was going to fight a speeding ticket Alfin brought an attorney who fought that, but they didn't know Kent Keller, and Kent Keller always presented us with this book showing the calibrations and all this kind of stuff, and so most people didn't win their cases. And the times that Judge Verkamp was upset with rangers is when they would go out of their way to assist somebody getting in trouble. And the most common example of this was when the pub was still there.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the night shift rangers would wait outside the pub, see somebody stumble to their car, and when they got in the car and started to drive, they'd stop them and arrest them for DUI. And the judge's case was, you should have seen that they were impaired before they got to their car. Give them a ride home. Then wait for them to get in the car for DUI.
Nice. Yeah.
And
yeah.
I personally agree with that. But on the other hand, I don't want to take sides and all. I mean, I didn't do that. But the person did get in their car, and if we had just driven up, it would have been drunk driving. But I remember there was somebody who was impaired, who worked for the National Park Service in uniform, who was walking to their car one day in broad daylight. And I said, don't get in that car and make me arrest you for DUI. And he knew I would do it. And so he continued to walk home.
Right. Right.
Right. So,
which is just a simple courtesy as a courtesy from law enforcement to the public. You know, fair warning.
On the other hand, but on the other hand, we have people who are not nice people on the other side of the bench.
Of course.
Who deserve to go to jail for whatever they did. But that doesn't mean we have to always assist them in going to jail.
That's right.
But it's a different in philosophy in how you were raised. And there are some people in protection who believe it is their job to get the people doing their worst so that they get better. Does that make sense? Rather than give them a chance and they'll say, oh, I got away with it, so now I can drive again. I don't know if it makes sense.
No.
I did talk to some people about that, and they thought, well, they feel like they can get away with it now because we were too nice to them.
Do you think that judge, but still there's a civility issue here, and do you think that Judge Verkamp's admonitions to the protection rangers that were not baiting people, but not assisting them either, when they saw there was a clear danger, didn't provide assistance, but waited to entrapment.
Not entrapment, because we didn't give them the drink and we didn't park their car there.
Right, so that's not the right word, but it's like, okay, I see Fred, and Fred's drunk. I can walk up to Fred and say, Fred, look, get in the patrol car, you drive home, just give me your keys, leave your car here. No, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to wait until Fred gets in his car. And then, as soon as he pulls out.
Here's the frustration. Most places, a DUI, driving under the influence of drug or alcohol, is very straightforward. In the National Park Service, we have a code of federal regulations. And there's also a code in there that allows us to absorb certain state statutes. Like in the National Park Service at Grand Canyon, we had no law against domestic violence. So we couldn't do anything against somebody other than stop it. We couldn't arrest somebody for domestic violence if we didn't have this special statute that allowed us to absorb the state's law that we could arrest somebody for this. But if we already have an existing statute, we can't take the state. So we had a statute being under the influence of drug or alcohol in a park area so it's a two-pronged thing.
Okay.
It is not against, and this is the one thing that the judge kept pointing out, it is not against the law to be drunk in a national park.
Okay.
And so so you have to be doing something illegal to do it.
Got it.
So you have to be a danger to yourself, cause property damage, a danger to other people.
Okay.
I remember particular in front of the Maswick Lodge steel-toed cowboy boots, a Native American, was stumbling around, and we got in a call that he was using expletives and yelling at people in front of the Maswick Lodge, a kind of schizophrenic-like behavior, but he was intoxicated. So I pulled up, and there he was, and I, sir, you need to calm down, why don't I take you home? He wasn't somebody I recognized, and why don't we do this? And he said, F you, and several other choice things to me. Now, it specifically says that a law enforcement officer cannot be offended by foul language.
Mm-hmm.
So if there was nobody out there and he's calling me all the sailor names in the book, I can't arrest him for disorderly conduct. But okay. because there was a crowd there, that allowed me to detain and potentially arrest him for disorderly conduct for that. And so because it is not illegal to be drunk in a national park.
Mm.
So to finish the story and get back to why the Rangers objected somewhat to Judge Verkamp's what he's saying is so because there were people around who I assumed were offended by his language, I could then arrest him for disorderly conduct. And as we did so, I called in backup. We had plenty of backup. And then the fight was on. He started kicking us, spitting at us, all this stuff. And we were trained to be very careful with people and to say, calm down, sir. We don't want you to be hurt. Calm down, sir. We pulled his boots off because he was kicking us with these steel-toed boots.
Mm-hmm.
And we were very good. In fact, it was three gals on this. There was no guys involved in this particular arrest. And we put him in the car and off we went.
Mm-hmm.
And as I looked up afterwards, there were all these video cameras on us.
Uh-huh.
So there were video cameras back then. But we did what we needed to do. We said what we needed to do. You know, and then one of the things I pointed out at the time afterwards when we did an after-action review was in the movies pit, you know, say, get your hands up, you mother effer, and all this kind of stuff. You never use that language in real life,
right.
in my opinion.
Right.
And so you're trying to reason with people.
Right.
So here's the deal. If there were no people there and this guy was drunk walking around Maswick, there's nothing I could do about it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So this guy walking to his car, you can go in and say, you're drunk, let me give you a ride home, but he doesn't have to comply, and it's not illegal to be drunk. And so most rangers say, why bother? I'm going to wait till he does the second thing. He's a danger to himself, others, or property, and now I can take action.
And so what did Judge Verkamp say to that defense?
I can't tell you exactly what he said, but the gist of it was, is be an assist rather than a cop. So
Nice. Assist
these people home
rather
than wait them in the car. And the rangers who were doing this felt like they were cops, not social workers.
Right. Uh-huh.
So,
sure.
So I
get that argument.
It was
also
a matter of tenor. And pretty soon, Judge Verkamp was throwing these cases out or doing something that said, you know, and what Judge Verkamp did is he just would go to the superintendent and say, your rangers need to stop doing this. You know, I don't want to see them in my court.
Mm-hmm.
If I see this ranger in my court, I'm going to throw him out and I'll throw the case out because I don't want this person who's doing these things in my court. And that's why Judge Verkamp was so difficult in some ways, because it was my court, my park, my law.
Mm-hmm.
So you did it his way,
right.
Which to me was not a big deal because we were kind of on the same wavelength.
Right.
Now, I sent you copies of something called RMPR.
Thank you so very much for doing that. I did, and I emailed you back, but I don't know if you got my email.
I didn't.
Because I would love to put those up on the website somewhere.
Oh, I can send you the whole set if you like.
Yes, please. Those were great.
Thank you. But they're called Resource Management and the Protect and Ranger. And there was something called Ranger Futures. It turns out that if you wanted to be a park ranger and wanted to get a fair pay that you could live on, you had to be, you know, law enforcement, emergency medical services, search and rescue, and a resource manager. And the resource manager is where you got, quote, the money, unquote. And so if you just were there as a protection ranger, there wasn't as much money. So Ranger Futures was a way of bringing that in, making us resource managers on top of everything else. Well, I had come up with this idea to do this to help assist people. I already had a master's degree in biology, and I already was been a resource manager. And so I wanted to show the resource through the eyes of protection. And you saw through those that's what I did.
Right.
Almost
they were great.
Every copy I brought up, a Code of Federal Regulations or the Lacey Act or something like that, and explained it and show how it was important to a protection ranger to know this law, to enforce these laws, to use them as a tool to not just protect the resource, but protect the people. And so the problem we have in the national parks, and I mentioned this before, there's five or six parks from Gateway to Golden Gate to Grand Teton, Yellowstone, Grand Canyon, where you don't have the time for the resource you would like to have as a protection ranger, because that's our number one job, is to protect the resource. Mm. There's so many people, 50,000 people a day, 3 million to 6 million people a year, that you have to deal 99% of the time with the problems people bring to each other's and to the resource. And so, like I said, that's why there came a time where they were thinking about bringing just straight police officers to Grand Canyon and let the rangers be the resource officers.
Hmm.
And so to keep it, that separation from happening, that's where Ranger Futures came in. So you could do everything still,
okay,
which I really loved.
Did you ever, in Judge Verkamp's court, find yourself rocked back on your heels for some really wonderful logic or wonderful presentation of the case that Judge Verkamp expounded upon? Sometimes judges can just have this eloquence that just kind of rolls you back on your heels and makes you really think about things. Was he that kind of judge?
No.
Okay.
I wish I could remember an instance of that. But to be honest with you, the only thing that stands out in my mind is there was a case of a person that I arrested for driving under the influence of alcohol. And the case was very peculiar in that he was pulled over to the side of the road. It was nighttime. He was drunk. I came up to see if he was okay, and the keys were in the ignition, and he was very intoxicated. He wanted to drive off. He wouldn't comply, and I ended up arresting him. And so his lawyer's contention was that he wasn't driving the car. He was in the car parked. But I said to him on the stand, and Jennifer and I had talked about the strategy, and I said, however, the definition of control of the vehicle is in the driver's seat with the key in the ignition.
Hmm.
And the defense attorney came right back at me saying, but he wasn't driving and you didn't see his behavior. And I said, I stopped as a welfare check to find out why the guy's lights were on, because he fell asleep with his foot on the brake light and the brake lights were on.
Hmm.
And he was parked partway in the road and partway on, so we created a hazard.
Right.
And so I'm trying to explain myself. And then before I could even finish, he just comes right back at me again. And the gavel comes down, and this is what I remember most. And I can't even tell you what he said, but Judge Verkamp said, and he called me Ranger Meekum at the time, because I didn't go by Melody Meekum at the time. He goes, Ranger Meekum has the most integrity of any ranger I've ever had. She will never lie in my court, and I will not allow you to badger her in this manner.
Wow.
And so he defended me to the hilt.
Hmm.
So if you, and he used, I used to give him my RMPR.
Mm-hmm.
And he used to call them his Meekum minutes. And if he wasn't, he goes, where are my Meekum minutes? And I said, it's out tomorrow. I'm working mm-hmm. on it. Because the resource was the most important thing to him. And I would talk to him about, you know, kids out at the site on Rowell Road, where they would have their fires and stuff and things like that. And he said, we used to go out there too and have fires. Or, I don't know if he did, but his high school was in. He goes, it's not a right thing to do, and they're messing things up. And so he would talk about the resource and how important it was, bighorn sheep. So, you know, he was very possessive of the Grand Canyon and that it be taken care of.
That's a good thing to have in a judge, I think.
I think so. But it was a very peculiar situation, because most judges are neutral. And I have this because I presented cases in other courts,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
Inyo County courts and things like that. And the judge hears the case, the judge hears the merits of the case, and based upon the merits of the case on both sides, he makes a judgment. He doesn't use his background in a place to judge the merits of the case.
I see what you're saying. That's a good point.
Peculiar.
Yeah. Hmm.
Yeah. So it was very interesting. But in this case, national parks are unique and different. I had to appear in court in Sequoia National Park. I don't know if you want to hear the story, but
yeah, sure, because it relates.
I was a naturalist at Sequoia National Park at the time, a seasonal naturalist, and at the time we were giving tours of a cave there called Crystal Cave, and it was a tour during the daytime, and people came in, and there was a naturalist at the front and a naturalist at the back, so we didn't leave anybody behind.
Mm-hmm.
And we noticed that there were some people from the Naval Air Station, Lemoore, who were on the tour, and they acted intoxicated. Now, I'm not a federal law enforcement officer. I have no training in drunk people other than having seen drunks.
Okay.
And, you know, I said, you guys need to step up with the group. And he reached over and broke off a stalactite. And I said, you need to keep your hands to yourself. And so I'm giving these guys some warnings and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So we go to this big room where they are, where you turn off the lights and it's total darkness. And people get to see what total darkness is like. And they did, and they started to howl like coyotes. And they just were disruptive, and it was just awful. And so the tour couldn't be over soon enough because it was just the tour from hell. And because of these three guys who were drunk and obnoxious and disorderly. So when we got out, we had a ticket booth at the bottom. And so we used the radio to call the law enforcement people and said, these drunks broke stalactites. They were putting their hands on the formations. They were disrupting the tour. And when they got to the top of the hill, which is a 400-foot climb, the protection rangers were waiting for them. And I don't remember if they arrested them or gave them mandatory citations. They probably arrested them because they were drunk. I don't know. But sometime later, I had to appear as a witness in a court by Judge Coombs. And I believe it's C-O-O-M-B-S. And this was 1979 or 80. And this was down at the Ash Mountain headquarters. Again, another circuit court. This was a judge who went to this court and I assume went to others. And so they came in and they had a lawyer and I had to come up there and describe all the damage that they had done. And then I said, and when I turned off the lights, they howled like coyotes. And Judge, he must have been having a blast at this point because in a very straight face, he turns to me and he goes, Miss Melitti, because I wasn't even married at the time, he goes, for the benefit of the court, so we know how disruptive they were, what did they sound like? And I said, you want me to make the sound that they sound? And yes, yes, please. So here I'm on the stand in a federal court going, oh, 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 oh. And I thought, and he said, thank you very much. And the defense attorney sat down at that point starting to object because he just glared at them.
Huh.
And so after the court was finished, and he just said, guilty on all charges, and here's your fine, and pay the fine, and you're free to go.
Wow.
And it's the first time I'd ever had that experience. And afterwards, I didn't know anybody because, you know, I'm not protection.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just a naturalist down there. And he goes, they said, the judge wants you to wait. And so I waited. So there were like three or four or five of us. I can't remember.
Mm-hmm.
The presenting officer, and he goes, he's taking us all out to lunch in Three Rivers. So out we went to lunch in Three Rivers. Judge Coombs buying. I said, okay.
Huh.
And so I'll never forget that. This is the first time I was in the federal court. I had to howl like a coyote.
Mm. To a judge that may have had a familial connection to an area and was really irritated by people who weren't sensitive to their location and what they were doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I kind of see where Judge Verkamp's coming from, because he's not the only guy, it sounds like, who's got that sense of place.
I don't know Judge Coombs from Adam. I don't know where he's from. He just was a federal magistrate court. Magistrate. I don't know if he's from Sequoia or Liberty.
Might be,
or
might
from
not
San
be.
Francisco.
Right.
I don't know where he's from, but he had a sense of humor, let me put it that way.
Yeah, yeah.
So anyway, different courts, different things.
Uh-huh.
But outside of court, when I would talk to Judge Verkamp and we would talk of different things, he really cared and he really wanted to get things right. And so I really thought a lot of him at the time, because he and I were on the same wavelength. That doesn't mean that the other people were wrong, but they just weren't on my wavelength.
Yeah.
I didn't favor what they did, but I have to be very careful about objecting to behavior that is not wrong, but just because I don't agree with it.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. No, but it's just really fascinating to see, you know, a judge that clearly gets a sense of place and wants to preserve it.
Yes.
And yet has the willingness in a Les Miserables kind of way to say, look, you know, as a protection ranger, you need to be a person as well. You need to have a heart as well.
Yes, and like I said, and it is because of that kind of behavior that the community called them the night shift Nazis, the summer night shift Rangers.
Yeah.
And they were very hardcore, and some of them were not nice people, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And we did not socialize with these people. And it was tough after a while as a part of the community, because this had never happened to us before. That when I was at Death Valley and I was in protection, and I was even protection at Sequoia as a collateral duty for a while. They issued me a weapon, but just because I had my commission in case they needed an extra hand, but I never had to use it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But one of the fun things like at Death Valley was potlucks and games and all this kind of stuff. And when Kent and I first moved to the Grand Canyon, we went to the potlucks and stuff. And I remember the very first potluck I went to, or not the first one, but second or third, that my supervisor came over and said, tomorrow is short haul training and you're going. And I said, yes, uh-huh. He says, the pilot, and he gave me his name, he said, was arrested yesterday for drunk driving.
Hmm.
So you be careful and be aware. I said, oh, okay, because he was worried about revenge, you know, dropping me on the ground or squishing me, because I was a protection ranger.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't arrest him, but somebody else did. And the more time I spent at Grand Canyon, the less time we went to these potlucks, because people stopped talking.
Hmm.
Oh, they're a protection ranger. Suddenly, you know, everybody's what they did wrong, what their medical background is, because you've taken them to the hospital.
Right.
You know their most intimate details, the fight they had with their spouse that you had to break up. It was no longer, you were no longer a part of the community. You were really on the outside. And that was a really hard part of being a protection ranger, was suddenly being not welcomed. And that, and I'd never experienced that before anywhere except Grand Canyon.
The community
just piled you all together in one big pot.
Yeah, yeah. No, this is a really fascinating thing, which I saw at the clinic, and good that you're bringing this up. Which is, we're friends, and we can pal around and do this and that, but when you put that hat on, and you're in your tactical gear, and you're with your patrol car, and you watch me run a stop sign, I run a stop sign, and I'm no longer your best friend. I'm a citizen who's run a stop sign, and your job is to give me a ticket.
And it's moments like that, and I'm going to use a bad word, that I get pissed, because they know I have to do that. They know I have integrity, that I'm not going to let people off. And I said, and I would say something like this, like, why have you put me in this position?
Right.
You know better. I thought you would give me off. No, I'm going to give you a ticket instead.
Right.
And that would be it.
Right.
And it would make me angry because, anyway, it would really make me angry because it was just another chink in the separation of me being a part of the community.
Right, right. And I think that the community needs to understand that we may be friends, you know, we may be drinking buddies at the bar, but as soon as you go to work and you're doing your job, if I break law, you are going to correct that.
Yeah.
That's
well,
how it works.
It's interesting that you say drinking buddies at the bar. I mean, I don't drink and I never did drink, but you would never do that because...
Meaning we're at a potluck and we're singing songs or we're
but the first time you need somebody, you're calling me.
Right.
The next time you have a medical, you're calling me. Your next time some animal is a rabid animal is attacking you, you're calling me.
Mm-hmm.
You use us as you need us, but then afterwards you don't need us anymore, and it hurts.
Mm.
It really hurts.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's a fascinating dilemma.
Yeah.
One of many dilemmas that...
Which is one of the reasons that, quote, cops gather together after hours with other cops, because nobody else understands this and nobody else wants them around.
Right.
Because we know the secrets.
Well, that, but the smart people are going to say, you know, these people are smart, intelligent, and there's no reason to ignore them. And when I run a stop sign, well, Fred over here is going to, if he happens to be sitting in his patrol car, he's going to give me a ticket. But that's just his job, and it doesn't mean that we can't socialize, and I can't learn a lot from this person, because...
That's a very reasonable grown-up concept.
Yeah, it takes a while to get there.
A lot of people don't possess.
Right.
And people are resentful,
mm.
and if the story gets out there, you're That's why my reputation of integrity and honesty, goodwill, was huge to me, huge. I never wanted to mess that up, screw it up. It was who it was what defined me.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I explained Giglio Henshorn earlier. Did I do that? Giglio Henshorn is a...
How do you spell that?
That was Giglio Henshorn, and I believe there's a hyphen in between it.
Okay.
Every year we had to go to 40 hours law enforcement refresher training. And I remember specifically one year, and this was in the mid-90s, I think it was, that they said, do your taxes, do them right. Don't take any payment under the table. Do, you know, da-da-da-da-da.
Mm-hmm.
And they said there's been a ruling in the federal court, and there was a officer, and I think it was Giglio, and then I can't remember who was the good guy and who was the bad, whatever
mm-hmm.
it was. But,
mm-hmm.
but what happened is an officer arrested somebody for some reason, and the defense attorney found out that the arresting officer, and I think it was a DUI, had a construction business on the side or something on the side, and he cheated on his taxes and got caught and had to pay fines to the government. And this was in the public record, I suppose. I don't know how else he got it. And then when it was his turn to cross-examine, so you're saying that my client was driving across the double yellow line, and I'm paraphrasing what the wrong was.
Right.
Just to give you an idea. And you want us to take your word for that, and it's exactly right. As a sworn federal officer, that's right. A sworn federal officer who's cheated on their taxes and lied to the federal government already
right.
about that.
That's right.
So the judge threw the case out.
Right.
And that officer lost his job. He could never, ever testify in court again because his ability to tell the truth was in question.
Compromised.
So, compromised, good word. So we were all very much warned about Giglio Henshorn. It said, if you were honest before, you got to be really honest now if you want to keep your jobs.
Yeah.
Because you cannot be compromised, and it's in court, and it was all in court. So you can do anything you want to, but if you're going to arrest somebody and they go to court, if they knew that you were one of those Giglio Henshorn compromised people, all they have to bring that up is, and their client is off, and you have no job.
Right, right.
So it was a real reckoning for people, you know, to be really honest. And I didn't have an issue with it because that was my MO anyway, to be honest. But
right.
There
right.
are people, and I've already described the case where somebody took somebody's money just so they couldn't play bail.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right.
So.
Right. Wow, fascinating ins and outs of this that you don't necessarily think about.
Yeah, so we were in court, Judge Verkamp. And that Verkamp reminds me of the buildings up on the rim. You had the El Tavar Hotel, and adjacent to that you had the Hopi House, and then you had Verkamp. And they were all, I believe El Tavar was built in 1905, and the Hopi House was built, I believe, specifically so that the indigenous people that we call Hopi from the Second Mesa could live there and then make things for visitors and do dances and present things to them. And that pretty much went away over time, and it turned into a tourist store, you know, come and buy a blanket and this and that and everything. One of our jobs is to make sure a building is clear if we think somebody is inside burglarizing it.
Okay.
And so we would often get alarms would go off or something would happen, and it might be a ringtail cat or a skunk or something, but it could also be a person. And I remember I was on night shift at one time, and the alarm for the Hopi House went off. And fire and security, as they were called, they're called fire and safety now, but they to be a kinder, gentler, they were called fire and security when I first was there, were not allowed to go in their buildings because they had no sidearms, they had no law enforcement training, they just were in charge of their buildings. And so they try to deal with things, and then if they thought it was something serious, then we showed up. So they showed up, and there's only two of us on night shift. So I asked him to stay outside the building where he could see most of the building, and then his colleague would look at the other, so all four sides were in view.
Okay.
And that's what you do when you do a building search, is you have somebody on the outside so they can watch the entire building, and usually two of you go in and search the building. Well, there was only one of me because I don't know where my colleague was, and we thought it was probably just another ringtail cat. But you have to, what we say, clear the building. So this was early on. This was in the early 90s. I want to say 91, 92, 93, somewhere down there. So I went throughout the store. I checked the cash register. I checked the doors. And I went up to the second floor. And I'd never been up to the second floor before. And they had told me that there was a ladder that went to a storage area at the top. I said, so I took this ladder, and it was like the one you put against your house, but it was made of wood. It wasn't like an A-frame ladder. So I carefully went up there, and I went to this attic space that I was kind of ducked over a little bit. And then there was a door almost immediately, and it was I could stand up there, but the door was short. There was no lock on the door, so I opened up the door, and I shined my light in there, and I just gasped at the treasure of Hopi Kachina dolls, baskets, blankets, full-size Kachina dolls. It was something in a Tony Hillerman mystery. There were hundreds of things up there that were authentic, and they were real. They were not trinkets.
Wow.
And I was, oh my God. And I walked through there. There was dust all over them. Decades old.
Huh.
But they were headdresses and feathers.
Wow.
And like I said, it was big ollas and pots. And I was just blown away. And so I came back and I closed the door and went back down and came all the way back out. And I said, building's cleared. I said, have you ever been upstairs before? And they said, no. And I said, okay. And so it had to be at least 2 or 3 years into my thing because of what I did next. Because I had been reading Tony Hillerman's stories, who's a Hillerman, who was a Haole, that's a Hawaiian word for it. I'm trying to think of the Hopi word for somebody who was not Hopi. A white person who wrote Hopi stories and very popular in the Southwest. Anyway, he wrote a book I know called Thieves of Time or something like that. It was people who stole old 100-plus-year-old artifacts from people and then sold them under the table.
Right.
Well, that's what this thing was full of, authentic artifacts.
Hmm.
So the next day I called the Hopi Reservation. I called all kinds of people going, what do I do? I found all this stuff there. They said, we don't know. And is it belong to Verkamps? Does it belong to the Hopi house? Who owns it? I said, I don't know who owns it. What do I do? And I didn't know what to do. And so I made appeals, and I talked to my supervisor, and I told him what I found, and never heard a thing from it.
Hmm.
Lo and behold, 6 months later, another alarm, and I couldn't wait to see the stuff. This time I brought a camera. Cleared the building, went upstairs, opened the door, empty.
Hmm.
Totally empty. So up in the Hopi house, I'm convinced, was easily $1 million worth of artifacts.
Wow.
That are disappeared.
Wow.
And that was my Grand Canyon mystery. Pretty cool.
I wonder.
But when I saw the full standing kachinas, I went aghast because I thought it was a person at first.
Wow. Yeah, I wonder where they went. I mean, you must have notified Zantara, or it would have been 91.
It wasn't Zantara. It was still Fred Harvey, I think.
So Fred Harvey sold at AmFac TRW Services. And those guys, it could have been them.
Well, I asked fire and security. I said, do you know what's up there? And I said, there's all kinds of, there were masks, lots of masks and stuff up
there.
Wow. No, yeah.
Wow.
It was amazing.
Huh.
Just amazing.
Huh.
But then the next time we went up, they cleaned it out.
Somebody cleaned it out, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, somebody cleaned
it. And
then
another time when I went up there was a lock on that door. Who knows what was after it.
Oh, interesting. Huh.
Mystery.
Yeah, yeah. So we knew the value and moved that stuff out of there. Wow.
I remember there was a house, a big building. There was a loop that went from the Bright Angel around the railroad tracks and stuff, and there was an old building that used to be the power building. I'm trying to remember what we used to call it.
The powerhouse? The big...
I thought we called it something other than the powerhouse.
Okay.
But maybe it was a powerhouse. But anyway, it was like 3, 4, or 5 stories. I forget how it is.
Right.
It had nooks and crannies and ladders and stuff. And we used to go in there and practice clearing the buildings. And it was just such a pain in the butt.
I bet.
There's
galleyways and all kinds of catwalks up high and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah. So it's a little bit scary.
Hmm.
And one of the favorite places to go, and this was when I was as a winter naturalist, was Kolb Studio.
Hmm.
And it was neat going to Kolb Studios before they renovated it, because you could see all the furniture, you could see all their everything the way it was, as if the Kolbs just walked out the door.
Uh-huh.
And one of the interesting things, I think it was Emery who was there.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And he was very, very old, and in his afternoon 80s, and he got really decrepit, and he would sit in front of one of the bay windows in the chair, and the chair was still there, and so was the carpeting underneath.
Huh.
And the story I had learned is he would never bother to get up to go to the bathroom. He'd just unzip and pee down on the carpet, and sure enough, there's this great big stain on the carpet
below
the chair.
Huh.
I mean, all these stories and cobwebs and stuff. So it was interesting. And then we renovated it and made it part of the Grand Canyon Association, and I missed that ambiance.
Yeah, it's a gorgeous building now. I mean, they just did a lot of work at it. But it's really fascinating because of the animosity between Kolb and the Park Service for decades and decades. And
And the brothers, too.
Right.
Ellsworth and Emery.
Ellsworth. And then finally, eventually, the park, through some very creative work by some very smart people, were able to, the park came around to see the value of keeping that building and preserving it. So.
Well, one of the interesting things, because as a naturalist, I used to give tours in the building for people on special occasions.
Oh.
And there was a place where you would go in and you'd open a door and there was the wall of the Grand Canyon.
Right.
You know, and one of the things the Park Service did when they acquired Kolb Studio is they realized it wasn't secured to anything. You just build a box on the ledge.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right.
And so one of the first things they had to do was secure it to the Grand Canyon so
that
next earthquake it wouldn't go
down the hill.
Down.
Yeah.
But one of the things they used to do is there was a room that overlooked the Bright Angel Trail, and there was a window where they would have their camera, and they would point the camera at the mule people coming back up.
That's right.
And then I think it was Ellsworth or Emery, one of them would then run down to Bright Angel because the water was brought to the south rim. I haven't thought of this in a long time, in railroad cars, but
right.
It was rusty water as a result. So we had to go all the way down to Bright Angel to develop the film in clear water, come all the way back up, develop the film. Oh, he would take the pictures as they went down, beat them down before they came back, have the pictures ready for them to buy on the way up.
That's right.
And I have a picture of my father's father on
the
hill taken by the Kolb brothers.
Wow.
Back in 1917, maybe? I forget what it is. No, it had to be younger than that. Cause, anyway, 12, something like that. But I have a picture of my grandpa going down on a mule in Grand Canyon taken by the Kolb brothers.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Cool.
He was an Irishman with his little cap on, you know.
Hmm. Oh, very fun. Well, this has been very helpful to sort of review the magistrate's court and get to know sort of the ins and outs of how that works. I had a question about the clerk. I'm assuming that the clerk in this case was Jennifer Cipher. That individual.
Well, we use the word differently. She's the court officer.
Court officer.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, the clerk is somebody who does paperwork. Court
okay.
officer is she is the prosecutor basically.
Right.
And so if somebody came in, she would often consult with the ranger and say, rather than have this go through a whole trial, we're going to plea this out. So, you know, one of the things that we were encouraged to do, and I didn't mind doing this at all, is if we were going to arrest somebody, is arrest them for as much as we could. So let's say it's drunk driving, no driver's license or suspended driver's license, no insurance. So you'd have no seatbelt. So you'd have 3 or 4 things.
Mm-hmm.
So when she made a plea bargain, she goes, okay, we're only going to cite you for the no insurance and the DUI. We're going to let slide the no driver's license. We're going to let slide this. We're going to let slide that. So she has bargaining tools.
Right, right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. But it seems as though that the court officer would have become really wonderfully versed in federal law, federal case law. Well, maybe it's the same thing again and again and again. Another drunk driving case. Okay, fine. But I would assume that there would be enough of a variety there. Of course, it could be wrong. To learn quite a bit about federal law and the rules
on
the books.
But that is where the onus is actually on the protection ranger. When we went to Flexi, and I remember reading my journal not too long ago, we had an AUSA, an assistant U.S. attorney, who presented the law to us.
Hmm.
And we had to know the law so we could apply it. The court officer has to know the law so that she could prosecute it. So we can't do anything. She can't do anything unless we bring in a legal case. And if we don't know the heck what we're doing here and know what the laws are, you know, 36 CFR 4.2, you know, I can actually recite some of it still,
uh-huh.
Unfortunately. And I used to make little cheat sheets that I could keep in my shirt pocket so I could write certain things out quickly. They can't do anything unless you know what you're doing in the field. So it's really important. And I used to keep the Code of Federal Regulations in my car.
Mm.
So I could refer to it,
okay.
And know what the assimilated codes were.
Mm.
And when you had a big case, and you brought up earlier before we talked Danny Ray Horning, you know, then that's a whole different ball of wax. And this is somebody who ended up being a murderer and a kidnapper and all that kind of stuff, loose in the Grand Canyon. And he's our responsibility.
Well, we've been talking for about an hour. Maybe this
Next
is a
time.
Good time to put a comma here, and we will talk about that individual and that event next time.
That sounds good.
Okay. Is there anything else you want to add to this before we wrap this?
I don't think so. I think we've been. It's been pretty deep in this one.
Yeah. No. This is fun. Okay. Well, with that, this will conclude part 11 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Nancy Maliti Meekum. Today is Wednesday, April 28th, 2021. Nancy, thank you so very much.
You're welcome, Tom.